Chapter 2. The Mare Tranquillitatis People's Circumlunar Zaibatsu. 28-12-15. Night never fell in the Zaibatsu. It gave Lindsay's suffering a timeless air, a feverish idyll of nausea. Antibiotics would have cured him, but sooner or later his body would have to come to terms with its new flora. To pass the time between spasms, Reuman entertained him with local anecdotes and gossip. It was a complex and depressing history, littered with betrayals, small-scale rivalries, and pointless power games. The algae farmers were the Zaibatsu's most numerous faction, glum fanatics, clannish and ignorant, who were rumored to practice cannibalism. Next came the mathematicians, a proto-shaper breakaway group that spent most of its time wrapped in speculation about the nature of infinite sets. The Zaibatsu's smallest domes were held by a profusion of pirates and privateers. The Hermes breakaways, the Grey Taurus radicals, the Grand Megalics, the Soyuz eclectics, and others, who changed names and personnel as easily as they cut a throat. They feuded constantly, but none dared challenge the Nephrine Black Medicals or the Geisha Bank. Attempts had been made in the past. There were appalling legends about them. The people beyond the wall had their own wildly varying mythos. They were said to live in a jungle of overgrown pines and mimosas. They were hideously inbred and afflicted with double thumbs and congenital deafness. Others claimed there was nothing remotely human beyond the wall, just a proliferating cluster of software which had acquired a sinister autonomy. It was, of course, possible that the land beyond the wall had been secretly invaded and conquered by aliens. An entire post-industrial folklore had sprung up around this enthralling concept, buttressed with ingenious arguments. Everyone expected aliens sooner or later. It was the modern version of the millennium. Reuman was patient with him. While Lindsay slept feverishly, he patrolled the Zaibatsu with his camera robot, looking for news. Lindsay turned the corner on his illness. He kept down some soup and a few fried bricks of spiced protein. One of Ryuman's stacks of equipment began to chime with a piercingly clear electronic bleeping. Ryuman looked up from where he sat, sorting cassettes.
"That's the radar," he said. "Hand me that headset, will you?"
Lindsay crawled to the radar stack and untangled a set of Ryuman's adhesive iPhones. Ryuman clamped them to his temples.
"Not much resolution on radar," he said, closing his eyes. "A crowd just arrived, pirates most likely. They're milling about the landing pad."
He squinted, though his eyes were already shut.
"Something very large is moving about with them. They've brought something huge. I'd better switch to telephoto."
He yanked the headset's cord and its plug snapped free. "I'm going outside for a look," Lindsay said. "I'm well enough."
"Wire yourself up first," Ryuman said. "Take that ear set and one of the cameras."
Lindsay attached the auxiliary system and stepped outside the zippered airlock into the curdled air. He backed away from Ryuman's dome toward the rim of the land panel. He turned and trotted to a nearby stile, which led over the low metal wall, and trained his camera upward.
"That's good," came Ryuman's voice in his ear. "Cut in the brightness amps, will you? That little button on the right. Yes, that's better. What do you make of it, Mr. Day?"
Lindsay squinted through the lens. Far above, at the northern end of the Zaibatsu's axis, a dozen sundogs were wrestling in freefall with a huge silver bag. "It looks like a tent," Lindsay said. "They're inflating it." The silver bag wrinkled, and tumesced suddenly, revealing itself as a blunt cylinder. On its side was a large red stencil as wide as a man was tall. It was a red skull with two crossed lightning bolts.
"Pirates," Lindsay said.
Ryuman chuckled.
"I thought as much."
A sharp gust of wind struck Lindsay. He lost his balance on the stile and looked behind him suddenly. The glass window strip formed a long white alley of decay. The hexagonal metaglass frets were speckled with dark plugs, jackstrawed here and there with heavy reinforcement struts. Leaks had been sprayed with airtight coats of thick plastic. Sunlight oozed sullenly through the gaps.
"Are you all right?" Ryuman said.
"Sorry," Lindsay said. He tilted the camera upward again. The pirates had gotten their foil balloon airborne and had turned on its pair of small pusher propellers. As it drifted away from the landing pad, it jerked once, then surged forward. It was towing something, an oddly shaped dark lump larger than a man.
"It's a meteorite," Ryuman told him. "A gift for the people beyond the wall. Did you see the dark rocks that stand in the sterilized zone? They're all gifts from pirates. It's become a tradition."
"Wouldn't it be easier to carry it along the ground?"
"Are you joking? It's death to set foot in the sterilized zone."
"I see. So they're forced to drop it from the air. Do you recognize these pirates?"
"No,"
Ryuman said.
"They're new here. That's why they need the rock."
"Someone seems to know them," Lindsay said. "Look at that." He focused the camera to look past the airborne pirates to the sloping gray-brown surface of the Zaibatsu's third land panel. Most of this third panel was bleak expanse of fuzz-choked mud with surging coils of yellowish ground fog. Near the third panel's blasted northern suburbs was a squat, varicolored dome, built of jigsawed chunks of salvaged ceramic and plastic. A foreshortened, ant-like crowd of sundogs had emerged from the dome's airlock. They stared upward, their faces hidden by filter masks. They had dragged out a large, crude machine of metal and plastic, fitted with pinions, levers, and cables. They jacked the machine upward until one end of it pointed into the sky. "What are they doing?" Lindsay said.
"Who knows?" Ryuman said. "That's the Eighth Orbital Army, or so they call themselves. They've been hermits up till now."
The airship passed overhead, casting blurred shadows onto all three land panels. One of the sundogs triggered the machine. A long metal harpoon flicked upward and struck home. Lindsay saw metal foil rupture in the airship's tail section. The javelin gleamed crazily as it whirled end over end, its flight disrupted by the collision and the curve of Coriolis force. The metal bolt vanished into the filthy trees of a ruined orchard. The airship was in trouble. Its crew kicked and thrashed in midair, struggling to force their collapsing balloon away from the ground attackers. The massive stone they were towing continued its course with weightless, serene inertia. As its tow line grew tight, it slowly tore off the airship's tail. With a whoosh of gas, the airship crumpled into a twisted metal rag. The engines fell, tugging the metal foil behind them in a rippling streamer. The pirates thrashed as if drowning, struggling to stay within the zone of weightlessness. Their plight was desperate, since the zone was riddled with slow, sucking downdrafts that could send flyers tumbling to their deaths. The rock blundered into the rippling edge of a swollen cloudbank. The dark mass veered majestically downward, wobbling a bit, and vanished into the mist. Moments later, it reappeared below the cloud, plummeting downward in a vicious Coriolis arc. It slammed into the glass and patchwork of the window strip. Lindsay, following it with his camera, heard the sullen crunch of impact. Glass and metal grated and burst free in a sucking roar. The belly of the cloud overhead bulged downward and began to twist. A white plume spread above the blowout with the grace of creeping frost. It was steam, condensing from the air in the suddenly lowered pressure. Lindsay held the camera above his head and leaped down onto the grimy floor of the window. He ran toward the blowout, ignoring Ryuman's surprised protests. A minute's broken field running brought him as close as he dared go. He crouched behind the rusted steel strut of a plug, 10 meters from the impact site. Looking down past his feet through the dirty glass, Lindsay saw a long tail of freezing spray fanning out in rainbowed crystals against the shine of the sunlight mirrors. A roaring vortex of sucking wind sprang up, slinging gusts of rain. Lindsay cupped one hand around the camera's lens. Motion caught his eye. A group of oxygen farmers in masks and coveralls were struggling across the glass from the bordering panel. They cradled a long hose in their arms. They lurched forward doggedly, staggering in the wind, weaving among the plugs and struts. Caught by the wind, a camouflaged surveillance plane crashed violently beside the hole. Its wreckage was sucked through at once. The hose jerked and bucked with a gush of fluid. A thick spray of gray-green plastic geysered from its nozzle, hardening in midair. It hit the glass and clung there. Under the whirlwind's pressure, the plastic warped and bulged but held. As more gushed forth, the wind was choked and became a shrill whistle. Even after the blowout was sealed, the farmers continued to pump plastic sludge across the impact zone. Rain fell steadily from the agitated clouds. Another knot of farmers stood along the window wall, leaning their masked heads together and pointing into the sky. Lindsay turned and looked upward with the rest. The sudden vortex had spawned a concentric surf of clouds. Through a crescent-shaped gap, Lindsay saw the dome of the 8th Orbital Army across the width of the Zaibatsu. Tiny forms in white suits ringed the dome, lying on the ground. They did not move. Lindsay focused the telephoto across the interior sky. The fanatics of the 8th Orbital Army lay sprawled on the fouled earth. A knot of them had been caught trying to escape into the airlock. They lay in a tangle, their arms outstretched. He saw no sign of the airship pirates. He thought for a moment that they had all escaped back to the landing port. Then he spotted one of them, mashed flat against another window panel.
"That was excellent footage," Ryuman said in his ear. "It was also very stupid."
"I owed you a favor," Lindsay said. He studied the dead. "I'm going over there," he decided.
"Let me send the robot. There'll be looters there soon."
"Then I want them to know me," Lindsay said. "They might be useful." He crossed another stile onto the land panel. His lungs felt raw, but he had decided never to wear a breathing mask. His reputation was more important than the risk. He skirted the Black Medical's stronghold and crossed a second window strip. He walked north to the ragtag junk dome of the Orbital Army. It was the only outpost in the entire third panel, which had been abandoned to a particularly virulent form of the blight. This had once been an agricultural zone, and the heightened fertility of the soil brought forth a patchy crop of ankle-high mold. Farm buildings, all pastel ceramic and plastic, had been looted but not demolished, and their stiff, inorganic walls and gaping windows seemed too long to lapse into an unattainable state of rot. The recluse's dome was built of plastic door panels, chopped to shape and caulked. The corpses lay frozen, their limbs oddly bent, for they had been dead before they hit the ground, and their arms and legs had bounced a little, loosely, with the impact. There was a curious lack of horror about the scene. The faceless masks and watertight bodysuits of the dead fanatics conveyed a sense of bloodless, prim efficiency. Nothing marked the dead as human beings, except the military insignia on their shoulders. He counted 18 of them. The lenses on the faces of the dead were fogged over with internal steam. He heard the quiet whir of aircraft. A pair of ultralights circled once and skidded in for a landing. Two of the airship pirates had arrived. Lindsay trained his camera on them. They dismounted, unplugging their credit cards, and the aircraft taxied off. They walked toward him in the half-crouching shuffle of people unused to gravity. Lindsay saw that their uniforms were full-length silver skeletons etched over a blood-red background. The taller pirate prodded a nearby corpse with his foot.
"You saw this?" he said in English.
"The spy planes killed them," Lindsay said. "They endangered the habitat."
"The 8th Orbital Army,"
the taller pirate mused, examining a shoulder patch. The second pirate muttered through her mask's filters.
"Fascists, anti-nationalist scum."
"You knew them?" Lindsay said.
"We dealt with them," said the first pirate. We didn't know they were here, though. He sighed. What a burn. Do you suppose there are others inside?
Only dead ones, Lindsay said. The planes use X-ray lasers.
Really? The first pirate said. Wish I could get my hands on one of those.
Lindsay twirled his left hand, a gesture in surveillance argot stating that they were watched. The taller pirate looked upward quickly. Sunlight glinted on the silver skull inlaid over his face. He looked at Lindsay, his eyes hidden behind gleaming, silver-plated eye sockets.
Where's your mask, citizen?
Here, Lindsay said, touching his face.
A negotiator, huh? Looking for work, citizen? Our last diplomat just took the plunge. How are you in freefall?
Be careful, Mr. President, the second pirate warned. Remember the confirmation hearings.
Let me handle the legal implications, the president said impatiently. I'll introduce us. I'm the president of the Fortuna Miners Democracy, and this is my wife, the Speaker of the House.
Lin Zay, with Kabuki Intrasolar, Lindsay said. I'm a theatrical impresario.
That's some kind of diplomat?
Sometimes, Your Excellency. The president nodded. The Speaker of the House warned.
Don't trust him, Mr. President.
The executive branch handles foreign relations, so shut the fuck up, the president snarled. Listen, citizen, it's been a hard day. Right now, we ought to be in the bank, having a scrub, maybe getting juiced. But instead, these fascists cut in on us with their surface-to-air stuff, a preemptive strike, you follow me? So now our airship's burned, and we've lost our fucking rock.
That's a shame, Lindsay said. The president scratched his neck.
You just can't make plans in this business. You learn to take it as it comes.
He hesitated.
Let's get out of this stink anyway. Maybe there's loot inside.
The Speaker of the House took a handheld power saw out of a holster on her red webbing belt and began to saw through the wall of the Sundog Dome. The caulk between the plastic panels powdered easily.
You gotta go in unexpected if you want to live, the president explained. Don't ever, never go in an enemy airlock. You never know what's in 'em.
Then he spoke into a wrist attachment. He used a covert operational jargon. Lindsay couldn't follow the words. Together, the two pirates kicked out the wall and stepped inside. Lindsay followed them, holding his camera. They replaced the burst-out panel, and the woman sprayed it with sealant from a tiny propellant can. The president pulled off his skull mask and sniffed the air. He had a blunt, pug-nosed, freckled face. His short, ginger-colored hair was sparse, and the skin of his scalp gleamed oddly. They had emerged into the communal kitchen of the 8th Orbital Army. There were cushions and low tables, a microwave, a crate of plastic-wrapped protein, and a half-dozen tall fermenting units bubbling loudly. A dead woman, whose face looked sunburned, sprawled on the floor by the doorway.
Good, the president said. We eat.
The Speaker of the House unmasked herself. Her face was bony, with slitted, suspicious eyes. A painful-looking skin rash dotted her jaw and neck. The two pirates stalked into the next room. It was a combination bunk room and command center, with a bank of harsh, flickering videos in a central cluster. One of the screens was tracking by telephoto. It showed a group of 9 red-clad pirates approaching on foot down the Zaibatsu's northern slope, picking their way through the ruins.
Here come the rest of us, the speaker said.
The president glanced about him.
Not so bad. We stay here, then. At least we'll have a place to keep the air in.
Something rustled under one of the bunks. The Speaker of the House flung herself headlong under the bed. Lindsay swung his camera around. There was a high-pitched scream and a brief struggle. Then she emerged, dragging out a small child. The speaker had pinned the child in a complicated one-handed arm lock. She got it to its feet. It was a dark-haired, glowering, filthy little creature of indeterminate sex.
It wore an 8th Orbital Army uniform cut to size. It was missing some teeth. It looked about 5 years old.
"So, they're not all dead," the president said.
He crouched and looked the child in the eye.
"Where are the rest of you?"
He showed it a knife. The blade flickered into his hand from nowhere.
"Talk, citizen, otherwise I show you your guts."
"Come on," said Lindsay. "That's no way to talk to a child."
"Are you kidding, citizen? Listen, this little squealer might be 80 years old. There are endocrine treatments."
Lindsay knelt by the child and tried to approach it gently. "How old are you? 4? 5? What language do you speak?"
"Forget it," the speaker of the house said. "There's only one small-sized bunk, see it? I guess the spy planes just missed this one."
"Or spared it," Lindsay said. The president laughed skeptically.
"Sure, citizen. Listen, we can sell this thing to the whore bankers. It ought to be worth a few hours' attention for us, at least."
"That's slavery," Lindsay protested.
"Slavery? What are you talking about? Don't get theological, citizen. I'm talking about a national entity freeing a prisoner of war to a third party. It's a perfectly legal commercial transaction."
"I don't want to go to the whores," the child piped up suddenly. "I want to go to the farmers."
"The farmers," said the president. "You don't want to be a farmer, micro-citizen. Ever had any weapons training? We could use a small assassin to sneak through the air ducts."
"Don't underestimate those farmers," Lindsay said. He gestured at one of the video screens. A group of 2 dozen farmers had walked across the interior slope of the Zaibatsu. They were loading the dead 8th orbitals onto 4 flat sledges drawn by shoulder harnesses.
"Blast," the president said. "I wanted to roll them myself."
He smirked.
"Can't blame 'em, I guess. Lots of good protein in a corpse."
"I want to go with the farmers,"
the child insisted. "Let it go," Lindsay spoke up. "I have business with the Geisha Bank. I can treat your nation to a stay." The Speaker of the House released the child's arm.
"You can?"
Lindsay nodded. "Give me a couple of days to negotiate it." She caught her husband's eye.
"This one's all right. Let's make him Secretary of State."
The Mare Tranquillitatis People's Circumlunar Zaibatsu. 2-1-16. The Geisha Bank was a complex of older buildings, shellacked airtight and connected by a maze of polished wooden halls and sliding paper airlocks. The area had been a red light district even before the Zaibatsu's collapse. The bank was proud of its heritage and continued the refined and eccentric traditions of a gentler age. Lindsay left the 11 nationals of the Fortuna Miners Democracy in an antiseptic sauna vault, being scrubbed by impassive bath boys. It was the first real bath the pirates had had in months. Their scrawny bodies were knobbed with muscle from constant practice in freefall jiu-jitsu. Their sweating skins were bright with fearsome tattoos and septic rashes. Lindsay did not join them. He stepped into a paneled dressing room and handed over his Nephrine Medical's uniform to be cleaned and pressed. He slipped into a soft brown kimono. A low-ranking male geisha in kimono and obi approached him.
"Your pleasure, sir."
"I'd like a word with the you're right, please." The geisha looked at him with well-bred skepticism.
"One moment. I will ask if our chief executive officer is prepared to accept guests."
He vanished. After half an hour, a blonde female geisha in business suit and obi appeared.
"Mr. Zay, this way, please."
He followed her to an elevator guarded by 2 men armed with electrode-studded clubs. The guards were giants. His head barely came to their elbows. Their long, stony faces were acromegalic, swollen jaws, cliff-like jutting cheekbones. They had been treated with hormonal growth factors. The elevator surged up 3 floors and opened. Lindsay faced a thick network of brightly colored beads. Thousands of dangling beaded wires hung from floor to ceiling. Any movement would disturb them.
"Take my hand," the banker said.
Lindsay shuffled behind her, thrashing and clattering.
"Step carefully," she said. "There are traps."
Lindsay closed his eyes and followed. His guide stopped. A hidden door opened in a mirrored wall. Lindsay stepped through it into the Yerite's private chamber. The floor was of ancient wood, waxed to a dark gleam. There were flat square cushions underfoot, in patterns of printed bamboo. In the long wall to Lindsay's left, glass double doors showed a sunlit wooden balcony and a splendid garden, where crooked pines and tall japonicas arched over curving paths of raked white pebbles. The air in the room smelled of evergreen. He was gazing on this world before its rot, an image of the past, projected on false doors that could never open. The Yarite was sitting cross-legged on a cushion. She was a wizened old mech with a tight-drawn mouth and hooded reptilian eyes. Her wrinkled head was encased in a helmet-like lacquered wig, skewered with pins. She wore an angular, flowered kimono, supported by starch and struts. There was room in it for three of her. A second woman knelt silently with her back to the right-hand wall, facing the garden's image. Lindsay knew at once that she was a shaper. Her startling beauty alone was proof, but she had that strange, intangible air of charisma that spread from the reshaped like a magnetic field. She was of mixed Asiatic-African gene stock. Her eyes were tilted, but her skin was dark. Her hair was long and faintly kinked. She knelt before a rack of white keyboards with an air of meek devotion. The Yarite spoke without moving her head.
"Your duties, Kitsune."
The girl's hands darted over the keyboards and the air was filled with the tones of that most ancient of Japanese instruments, the synthesizer. Lindsay knelt on a cushion facing the old woman. A tea tray rolled to his side and poured hot water into a cup with a chaste tinkling sound. It dipped a rotary tea whisk into the cup.
"Your pirate friends," the old woman said, "are about to bankrupt you."
"It's only money," Lindsay said.
"It is our sweat and sexuality. Did you think it would please us to squander it?"
"I needed your attention," Lindsay said. His training had seized him at once, but he was still afraid of the girl. He hadn't known he would be facing a shaper. And there was something drastically wrong with the old woman's kinesics. It looked like drugs or mechanist nerve alteration.
"You came here dressed as a Nephrine Black Medical," the old woman said. "Our attention was guaranteed. You have it. We are listening."
With Reuman's help, Lindsay had expanded his plans. The Geisha Bank had the power to destroy his scheme. Therefore, they had to be co-opted into it. He knew what they wanted. He was ready to show them a mirror. If they recognized their own ambitions and desires, he would win. Lindsay launched into his spiel. He paused midway to make a point. You can see what the black medicals hope to gain from the performance. Behind their walls, they feel isolated, paranoid. They plan to gain prestige by sponsoring our play. But I must have a cast. The Geisha Bank is my natural reservoir of talent. I can succeed without the black medicals. I can't succeed without you.
I see, the Yerite said. Now explain to me why you think we can profit from your ambitions.
Lindsay looked pained. I came here to arrange a cultural event. Can't that be enough? He glanced at the girl. Her hands flickered over the keyboards. Suddenly she looked up at him and smiled, slyly, secretly. He saw the tip of her tongue behind her perfect teeth. It was a bright, predatory smile, full of lust and mischief. In an instant it burned itself into his bloodstream. Hair rose on the back of his neck. He was losing control. He looked at the floor, his skin prickling.
All right, he said heavily. It isn't enough, and that shouldn't surprise me. Listen, madam. You and the medicals have been rivals for years. This is your chance to lure them into the open and ambush them on your own ground. They're naive about finance. Naive but greedy. They hate dealing in a financial system that you control. If they thought they could succeed, they'd leap at the chance to form their own economy. So let them do it. Let them commit themselves. Let them pile success on success until they lose all sense of proportion and greed overwhelms them. Then burst their bubble.
Nonsense, the old woman said. How can an actor tell a banker her business?
You're not dealing with a mech cartel, Lindsay said intensely, leaning forward. He knew the girl was staring at him. He could feel it. These are 300 technicians, bored, frightened, and completely isolated. They are perfect prey for mass hysteria. Gambling fever will hit them like an epidemic. He leaned back. Support me, madam. I'll be your point man, your broker, your go-between. They'll never know you were behind their ruin. In fact, they'll come to you for help. He sipped his tea. It tasted synthetic. The old woman paused as if she were thinking. Her expression was very wrong. There were none of the tiny subliminal flickers of mouth and eyelid, the movements of the throat that accompanied human thought processes. Her face was more than calm. It was inert.
It has possibilities, she said at last. But the bank must have control. Covert, but complete. How can you guarantee this?
It will be in your hands, Lindsay promised. We will use my company, Kabuki Intrasolar, as a front. You will use your contacts outside of Zaibatsu to issue fictitious stock. I will offer it for sale here, and your bank will be ambivalent. This will allow the Nephrines to score a financial coup and seize control of the company. Fictitious stockholders, your agents, will react in alarm and send in pleas and inflated offers to the new owners. This will flatter their self-esteem and overwhelm any doubts. At the same time, you will cooperate with me openly. You will supply me with actors and actresses. In fact, you will jealously fight for the privilege. Your geishas will talk of nothing else to every customer. You will spread rumors about me, my charm, my brilliance, my hidden resources. You will underwrite all my extravagances and establish a freewheeling, free-spending atmosphere of carefree hedonism. It will be a huge confidence trick that will bamboozle the entire world. The old woman sat silently, her eyes glazed. The low, pure tones of the synthesizer stopped suddenly. A tense hush fell over the room. The girl spoke softly from behind her keyboards.
It will work, won't it?
He looked into her face. Her meekness had peeled off like a layer of cosmetics. Her dark eyes shocked him. They were full of frank, carnivorous desire. He knew at once that she was feigning nothing, because her look was beyond pretense. It was not human. Without knowing it, he rose to one knee, his eyes still locked with hers.
Yes, he said. His voice was hoarse. It will work, I swear it to you.
The floor was cold under his hand. He realized that, without any decision on his part, he had begun to move toward her, half crawling. She looked at him in lust and wonder.
Tell me what you are, darling. Tell me really.
I'm what you are, Lindsay said.
Shaper's work.
He forced himself to stop moving. His arms began to tremble.
I want to tell you what they did to me, the girl said. Let me tell you what I am.
Lindsay nodded once. His mouth was dry with sick excitement.
All right, he said. Tell me, Kitsune.
They gave me to the surgeons, she said. They took my womb out, and they put in brain tissue. Grafts from the pleasure center, darling.
I'm wired to the ass and the spine and the throat, and it's better than being God. When I'm hot, I sweat perfume. I'm cleaner than a fresh needle, and nothing leaves my body that you can't drink like wine or eat like candy. And they left me bright, so that I would know what submission was. Do you know what submission is, darling?
No, Lindsay said harshly. But I know what it means not to care about dying.
We're not like the others, she said. They put us past the limits, and now we can do anything we like to them, can't we?
Her laugh sent a shuddering thrill through him. She leaped with balletic grace over her deck of keyboards. She kicked the old woman's shoulder with one bare foot, and the Yarite fell over with a crunch. Her wig ripped free with a shredding of tape. Beneath it, Lindsay glimpsed her threadbare skull riddled with cranial plugs. He stared.
Your keyboards, he said.
She's my front, Kitsune said. That's what my life is. Fronts and fronts and fronts. Only the pleasure is real. The pleasure of control.
Lindsay licked his dry lips.
Give me what's real, she said.
She undid her obi sash. Her kimono was printed in a design of irises and violets. The skin beneath it was like a dying man's dream of skin.
Come here, she said. Put your mouth on my mouth.
Lindsay scrambled forward and threw his arms around her. She slipped her warm tongue deep into his mouth. It tasted of spice. It was narcotic. The glands of her mouth oozed drugs. They sprawled on the floor in front of the old woman's half-lidded eyes. She slipped her arms inside his loose kimono.
Shaper, she said, I want your genetics all over me.
Her warm hand caressed his groin. He did what she said. The Mare Tranquillitatis People's Circumlunar Zaibatsu, 16-1-16. Lindsay lay on his back on the floor of Ryuman's dome, his long fingers pressed to the sides of his head. His left hand had two glittering impact rubies set in gold bands. He wore a shimmering black kimono with a faint pattern of irises set in the weave. His hakama trousers were of the modern cut. The right sleeve of his kimono held the fictitious corporate emblem of Kabuki Intrasolar, a stylized white mask striped across the eyes and cheeks with flaring bands of black and red. His sleeves had fallen back as he clutched his head and revealed an injection bruise on his forearm. He was on vasopressin. He dictated into a microphone. All right, he said. Scene 3, Amijima. Jihei says, No matter how far we walk, there will never be a place marked for suicides. Let us kill ourselves here. Then Koharu, Yes, that's true. One place is as good as another to die. But I've been thinking, if they find our dead bodies together, people will say that Koharu and Jihei committed a lover's suicide. I can imagine how your wife will resent and envy me. So you should kill me here. Then choose another spot, far away for yourself. Then Jihei says... Lindsay fell silent. As he had been dictating, Ryuman had occupied himself with an unusual handicraft. He was sifting what appeared to be tiny bits of brown cardboard onto a small slip of white paper. He carefully rolled the paper into a tube. Then he pinched the tube's ends shut and sealed it with his tongue. He put one end of the paper cylinder between his lips, then held up a small metal gadget and pressed a switch on its top. Lindsay stared, then screamed.
Fire! Oh my God! Fire! Fire!
Ryuman blew out smoke.
What the hell's wrong with you? This tiny flame can't hurt anything.
But it's fire! Good God! I've never seen a naked flame in my life!
Lindsay lowered his voice.
You're sure you won't catch fire?
He watched Ryuman anxiously.
Your lungs are smoking.
No, no. It's just a novelty, a small new vice.
The old mechanist shrugged.
A little dangerous, maybe, but aren't they all?
What is it?
Bits of cardboard soaked in nicotine. They've got some kind of flavoring, too. It's not so bad.
He drew on the cigarette. Lindsay stared at the glowing tip and shuddered.
Don't worry, Reuman said. This place isn't like other colonies. Fire's no danger here. Mud doesn't burn.
Lindsay sagged back to the floor and groaned. His brain was swimming in memory enhancements. His head hurt, and he had an indescribable tickling sensation, like the first fraction of a second during an onset of déjà vu. It was like being unable to sneeze.
You made me lose my place, he said peevishly. What's the use? When I think of what this used to mean to me, these plays that hold everything worth preserving in human life, our heritage before the mechs, before the shapers, humanity, morality, a life not tampered with.
Reuman tapped ashes into an upended black lens cap.
You're talking like a circumlunar native, Mr. Zay, like a concatenate. What's your homeworld? Crisium SSR? Copernican Commonwealth?
Lindsay sucked air through his teeth. Reuman said,
Forgive an old man's prying.
He blew more smoke and rubbed a red mark on his temple, where the iPhones fit.
Let me tell you what I think your problem is, Mr. Zay. So far, you've recited three of these compositions, Romeo and Juliet, the tragical history of Dr. Faustus, and now the love suicide at Amijima. Frankly, I have some problems with these pieces.
Oh, said Lindsay in a rising note.
Yes. First, they're incomprehensible. Second, they're impossibly morbid. And third, and worst of all, they're pre-industrial. Now let me tell you what I think. You've launched this audacious fraud, you're creating a huge stir, and you've set the whole Zaibatsu on its ear. For this much trouble, you should at least repay the people with a little fun.
Fun? Lindsay said.
Yes, I know these sun dogs. They want to be entertained, not clubbed by some ancient relic. They want to hear about real people, not savages.
But that's not human culture.
So what?
Ryuman puffed his cigarette.
I've been thinking. I've heard three plays now, so I know the medium. There's not much to it. I can whip one up for us in 2 or 3 days, I think.
You think so? Ryuman nodded.
We'll have to scrap some things.
Such as?
Well, gravity, first of all. I don't see how you can get any good dancing or fighting done except in free fall.
Lindsay sat up. Dancing and fighting, is it?
That's right. Your audience are whores, oxygen farmers, 2 dozen pirate bands, and 50 runaway mathematicians. They would all love to see dancing and fighting. We'll get rid of the stage. It's too flat. The curtains are a nuisance. We can do that with lighting. You may be used to these old circumlunars with their damned centrifugal spin, but modern people love freefall. These poor sun dogs have suffered enough. It'll be like a holiday for them.
You mean get up to the freefall zone somehow?
Yes, indeed. We'll build an aerostat, a big geodesic bubble, airtight. We'll launch it off the landing zone and keep it fixed up there with guy wires or some such thing. You have to build a theater anyway, don't you? You might as well put it in mid-air where everyone can see it.
Of course, Lindsay said. He smiled as the idea sank in. We can put our corporate logo on it.
Hang pennants from it.
Sell tickets inside. Tickets and stock. He laughed aloud. I know just the ones to build it for me, too.
It needs a name, Reuman said. We'll call it
The kabuki bubble.
The bubble,
Lindsay said, slapping the floor. What else? Ryuman smiled and rolled another cigarette.
Say, Lindsay said, let me try some of that.
Whereas, throughout this nation's history, its citizens have always confronted new challenges, and whereas the nation's Secretary of State, Lin Zay, finds himself in need of aeronautic engineering expertise that our citizens are uniquely fitted to supply, and whereas Secretary Zay, representing Kabuki Intrasolar, an autonomous corporate entity, has agreed to pay the nation for its labors with a generous allocation of Kabuki Intrasolar corporate stock. Now therefore be it resolved by the House of Representatives of the Fortuna Miners Democracy, the Senate concurring, that the nation will construct the Kabuki Bubble Auditorium, provide promotional services for Kabuki stock, and extend political and physical protection to Kabuki staff, employees, and property.
Excellent, Lindsay said. He authenticated the document and replaced the Fortuna state seal in his diplomatic bag.
It truly eases my mind to know that the FMD will handle security.
Hey, it's a pleasure, said the president. Any dip of ours who needs it can depend on an escort 24 hours a day, especially when you're going to the geisha bank, if you get my meaning.
Have this resolution copied and spread it through the Zaibatsu, Lindsay said. It ought to be a good 10-point stock advance. He looked at the president seriously.
But don't get greedy. When it reaches 150, start selling out, slowly, and have your ship ready for a quick getaway.
The president winked.
Don't worry, we haven't been sitting on our hands. We're lining up a class assignment from the mech cartel. A bodyguard gig ain't bad, but a nation gets restless. When the Red Consensus is shipshape again, then our time has come to kill and eat.
The Mare Tranquillitatis People's Circumlunar Zaibatsu, 13-3-16. Lindsay slept, exhausted, with his head propped against the diplomatic bag. An artificial morning shone through the false glass doors. Kitsune sat and thought, toying quietly with the keys of her synthesizer. Her proficiency had long since passed the limits of merely technical skill. It had become a communion, an art sprung from dark intuition. Her synthesizer could mimic any instrument and surpass it, rip its sonic profile into naked waveforms, and rebuild it on a higher plane of sterilized abstract purity. Its music had the painful, brittle clarity of faultlessness. Other instruments struggled for that ideal clarity, but failed. Their failure gave their sound humanity. The world of humanity was a world of losses, broken hopes, and original sin. A flawed world, yearning always for mercy, empathy, compassion. It was not her world. Kitsune's world was the fantastic, seamless realm of high pornography. Lust was ever present, amplified and tireless, broken only by spasms of superhuman intensity. It smothered every other aspect of life, as a shriek of feedback might overwhelm an orchestra. Kitsune was an artificial creature and accepted her feverish world with a predator's thoughtlessness. Hers was a pure and abstract life, a hot, distorted parody of sainthood. The surgical assault on her body would have turned a human woman into a blank-eyed, erotic animal. But Kitsune was a shaper, with a shaper's unnatural resilience and genius. Her narrow world had turned her into something as sharp and slippery as an oiled stiletto. She had spent 8 of her 20 years within the bank, where she dealt with customers and rivals on terms she thoroughly understood. Still, she knew there was a realm of mental experience taken for granted by humanity that was closed to her. Shame, pride, guilt, love. She felt these emotions as dim shadows, dark reptilian trash burnt to ashes in an instant by searing ecstasy. She was not incapable of human feeling. It was simply too mild for her to notice. It had become a second subconscious, a buried, intuitive layer below her post-human mode of thought.
Her consciousness was an amalgam of coldly pragmatic logic and convulsive pleasure. Kitsune knew that Lindsay was handicapped by his primitive mode of thought. She felt a kind of pity for him, a compassionate sorrow that she could not recognize or admit to herself. She believed he must be very old, from one of the first generations of shapers. Their genetic engineering had been limited, and they could scarcely be told from original human stock. He must be almost 100 years old. To be so old, yet look so young, meant that he had chosen sound techniques of life extension. He dated back to an era before shaperism had reached its full expression. Bacteria still swarmed through his body. Kitsune never told him about the antibiotic pills and suppositories she took, or the painful antiseptic showers. She didn't want him to know he was contaminating her. She wanted everything between them to be clean. She had a cool regard for Lindsay. He was a source of lofty and platonic satisfaction to her. She had the craftsman-like respect for him that a butcher might have for a sharp steel saw. She took a positive pleasure in using him. She wanted him to last a long time, so she took good care of him and enjoyed giving him what she thought he needed to go on functioning. For Lindsay, her affections were ruinous. He opened his eyes on the tatami mat and reached out at once for the diplomatic bag behind his head. When his fingers closed over the smooth plastic handle, an anxiety circuit shut off in his head. But that first relief only triggered other systems, and he came fully awake into a queasy combat alertness. He saw that he was in Kitsune's chamber. Morning was breaking over the image of the long-dead garden. False daylight slanted into the room, gleaming from inlaid clothes chests and the perspex dome of a fossilized bonsai. Some repressed part of him cried out within him, in meek despair. He ignored it. His new diet of drugs had brought the shaper schooling back in full force, and he was in no mood to tolerate his own weaknesses. He was full of that mix of steel trap irritability and slow, gloating patience that placed him at the keenest edges of perception and reaction. He sat up and saw Kitsune at the keyboards. "Good morning," he said.
"Hello, darling. Did you sleep well?"
Lindsay considered. Some antiseptic she used had scorched his tongue. His back was bruised where her shaper-strengthened fingers had dug in carelessly. His throat had an ominous rawness. He had spent too much time without a mask in the open air. "I feel fine," he said, smiling. He opened the complex lock of his diplomatic bag. He slipped on his finger rings and stepped into his Hakama trousers.
"Do you want to eat something?" she said.
"Not before my shot."
"Then help me plug in the front," she said.
Lindsay repressed a shudder. He hated the Yarite's withered, wax-like, cyborged body, and Kitsune knew it. She forced him to help her with it because it was a measure of her control. Lindsay understood this and wanted to help her. He wanted to repay her, in a way she understood, for the pleasure she had given him. But something in him revolted at it. When his training faltered, as it did between shots, repressed emotions rose, and he was aware of the terrible sadness of their affair. He felt a kind of pity for her, a compassionate sorrow that he would never insult her by admitting. There were things he had wanted to give her, simple companionship, simple trust and regard, simple irrelevance. Kitsune hauled the Yarite out of its biomonitored cradle beneath the floorboards. In some ways, the thing had passed the limits of the clinically dead. Sometimes they had to slam it into operation like push-starting a balky engine. Its maintenance technology was the same type that supported the machinist cyborgs of the radical old and the mech cartels. Filters and monitors clogged the thing's bloodstream. The internal glands and organs were under computer control. Implants sat on its heart and liver, prodding them with electrodes and hormones. The old woman's autonomous nervous system had long since collapsed and shut down. Kitsune examined a readout and shook her head.
"The acid levels are rising as fast as our stocks, darling. The plugs are degrading its brain. It's very old, held together with wires and patchwork.
She sat it up on a floor mat and spooned vitaminized pap into its mouth.
You should seize control on your own, he said. He inserted a dripping plug into a duct on the Yarite's veiny forearm. I'd like that, she said. But I have a problem getting rid of this one. The sockets on its head will be hard to explain away. I could cover them with skin grafts, but that won't fool an autopsy. The staff expect this thing to live forever. They've spent enough on it. They'll want to know why it died.
The Yarite moved its tongue convulsively and dribbled out its paste. Kitsune hissed in annoyance.
Slap its face, she said.
Lindsay ran a hand through his sleep-matted hair.
Not this early, he said, half pleading.
Kitsune said nothing, merely straightening her back and shoulders and set her face in a prim mask. Lindsay was defeated at once. He jerked his hand back and swung it across the thing's face in a vicious open-handed slap. A spot of color showed in its leathery cheek.
Show me its eyes, she said.
Lindsay grabbed the thing's gaunt cheeks between his thumb and fingers and twisted its head so that it met Kitsune's eyes. With revulsion, he recognized a dim flicker of debased awareness on its face. Kitsune took his hand away and lightly kissed his palm.
That's my good darling, she said.
She slipped the spoon between the thing's slack lips.
The Mare Tranquillitatis People's Circumlunar Zaibatsu, 21-4-16. The Fortuna pirates floated like red and silver paper cutouts against the interior walls of the Kabuki bubble. The air was loud with the angry spitting of welders, the whine of rotary sanders, the wheeze of the air filters. Lindsay's loose kimono and trousers ruffled in freefall. He reviewed the script with Ryuman.
You've been rehearsing this? He said.
Sure, said Ryuman. They love it. It's great. Don't worry.
Lindsay scratched his floating, puffy hair.
I don't quite know what to make of this.
A camouflaged surveillance plane had forced itself into the bubble just before the structure was sealed shut. Against the bright triangular pastels, its dreary camouflage made it as obvious as a severed thumb. The machine yawed and dipped within the 50-meter chamber, its lenses and shotgun microphones swiveling relentlessly. Lindsay was glad it was there, but it bothered him.
I have the feeling I've heard this story before, he said.
He flipped through the printout's pages. The margins were thick with cartoon stick figures scribbled there for the illiterate.
Let me see if I have it right. A group of pirates in the Trojan asteroids have kidnapped a Shaper woman. She's some kind of weapons specialist, am I right?
Ryuman nodded. He had taken his new prosperity in stride. He wore ribbed silk coveralls in a tasteful shade of navy and a loose beret, high fashion in the mech cartels. A silver microphone bead dotted his upper lip.
Lindsay said, The Shapers are terrified by what the pirates might do with her expertise, so they form an alliance and put the pirates under siege. Finally, they trick their way in and burn the place out.
Lindsay looked up.
Did it really happen, or didn't it?
It's an old story, Ryuman said. Something like that actually happened once, I feel sure of it. But I filed off the serial numbers and made it my own.
Lindsay smoothed his kimono.
I could swear that...
Hell, they say if you forget something while you're on vasopressin, you'll never remember it. It causes mnemonic burnout. He shook the script in resignation.
Can you direct it?
Ryuman said. Lindsay shook his head.
I wanted to, but it might be best if I left it to you. You do know what you're doing, don't you?
No.
Ryuman said cheerfully.
Do you?
No. The situation's getting out of hand. Outside investors keep trying to buy Kabuki stock. Word got out through the Geisha Bank's contacts. I'm afraid that the Nephrine Black Medicals will sell their Kabuki holdings to some mech cartel. And then
I don't know. It'll mean...
It'll mean that Kabuki Intrasolar has become a legitimate business.
Yes, Lindsay grimaced. It looks like the Black Medicals will escape unscathed. They'll even profit. The Geisha Bank won't like it.
What of it? Said Ryuman. We have to keep moving forward or the whole thing falls apart. The bank's already made a killing selling Kabuki stock to the Black Medicals. The old crone who runs the bank is crazy about you. The whores talk about you constantly.
He gestured at the center stage. It was a spherical area crisscrossed with padded wires where a dozen actors were going through their paces. They flung themselves through free-fall aerobatics, catching the wires, spinning, looping, and rebounding. Two of them collided bruisingly and clawed the air for a handhold. Ryuman said,
Those acrobats are pirates, you understand. 4 months ago they would have slit each other's throats for a kilowatt. But not now, Mr. Zay. Now they have too much at stake. They're stage-struck.
Ryuman laughed conspiratorially.
For once, they're more than pocket terrorists. Even the whores are more than sex toys. They're real actors, with a real script and a real audience. It doesn't matter that you and I know it's a fraud, Mr. Zay. A symbol has meaning if someone gives it meaning. And they're giving it everything they have.
Lindsay watched the actors begin their routine again. They flew from wire to wire with feverish determination. It's pathetic, he said.
A tragedy to those who feel, a comedy to those who think,
Ryuman said. Lindsay stared at him suspiciously.
What's gotten into you, anyway? What are you up to?
Ryuman pursed his lips and looked elaborately nonchalant.
My needs are simple. Every decade or so I like to return to the cartels and see if they've made any progress with these bones of mine. Progressive calcium loss is not a laughing matter. Frankly, I'm getting brittle.
He looked at Lindsay.
And what about you, Mr. Zay?
He patted Lindsay's shoulder.
Why not tag along with me? It would do you good to see more of the system. There are 200 million people in space, hundreds of habitats, an explosion of cultures. They're not all scraping out a living on the edge of survival like these poor Bezprizorniki. Some of them are the bourgeoisie. Their lives are snug and rich. Maybe technology eventually turns them into something you wouldn't call human. But that's a choice they make, a rational choice.
Ryuman waved his hands expansively.
This Zaibatsu is only a criminal enclave. Come with me, and let me show you the fat of the system. You need to see the cartels.
The cartels, Lindsay said. To join the mechanists would mean surrendering to the ideals of the radical old.
He looked around him, and his pride flared.
Let them come to me.
The Mare Tranquillitatis, People's Circumlunar Zaibatsu, 1-6-16. For the first performance, Lindsay gave up his finery for a general-issue jumpsuit. He covered his diplomatic bag with burlap to hide the kabuki decals. It seemed that every sundog in the world had filtered into the bubble. They numbered over 1,000. The bubble could not have held them except in freefall. There were light opera box frameworks for the bank elite and the jackstraw complex of padded bracing wires where the audience clung like roosting sparrows. Most floated freely. The crowd formed a percolating mass of loose concentric spheres. Broad tunnels had opened spontaneously in the mass of bodies, following the complex kinesics of crowd flow. There was a constant excited murmur in a flurry of deferring argots. The play began. Lindsay watched the crowd. Brief shoving matches broke out during the first fanfare, but by the time the dialogue started, the crowd had settled. Lindsay was thankful for that. He missed his usual bodyguard of Fortuna pirates. The pirates had finished their obligations to him and were busy preparing their ship for departure. Lindsay, though, felt safe in his anonymity. If the play failed disastrously, he would simply be one sun dog among others. If it went well, he could change in time to accept the applause. In the first abduction scene, pirates kidnapped the young and beautiful weapons genius, played by one of Kitsune's best. The audience screamed in delight at the puffs of artificial smoke and bright free-fall gushes of fake blood. Lexicon computers throughout the bubble translated the script into a dozen tongues and dialects. It seemed unlikely that this polyglot crowd could grasp the dialogue. To Lindsay, it sounded like naive mush mangled by mistranslation, but they listened raptly. After an hour, the first three acts were over. A long intermission followed, in which the central stage was darkened. Rude claques had formed spontaneously for the cast members as pirate groups shouted for their own. Lindsay's nose stung. The air inside the bubble had been supercharged with oxygen to give the crowd a hyperventilated elan. Despite himself, Lindsay too felt elation. The hoarse shouts of enthusiasm were contagious. The situation was moving with its own dynamics. It was out of his hands. Lindsay drifted toward the bubble's walls, where some enterprising oxygen farmers had set up a concessions stand. The farmers, clinging awkwardly to foot loops on the bubble's frame, were doing a brisk business. They sold their own native delicacies, anonymous green patties fried up crisp, and white blobby cubes on a stick, piping hot from the microwave. Kabuki Intrasolar took a cut, since the food stands were Lindsay's idea. The farmers paid happily in Kabuki stock. Lindsay had been careful with the stock. He had meant at first to inflate it past all measure and thereby ruin the black medicals. But the miraculous power of paper money had seduced him. He had waited too long, and the black medicals had sold their stock to outside investors at an irresistible profit. Now the black medicals were safe from him and grateful. They sincerely respected him and nagged him constantly for further tips on the market. Everyone was happy. He foresaw a long run for the play. After that, Lindsay thought, there would be other schemes, bigger and better ones. This aimless sundog world was perfect for him. It only asked that he never stop, never look back, never look farther forward than the next swindle. Kitsune would see to that. He glanced at her opera box and saw her floating with carnivorous meekness behind the bank's senior officers, her dupes. She would not allow him any doubts or regrets. He felt obscurely glad for it. With her limitless ambition to drive him, he could avoid his own conflicts. They had the world in their pocket, but below his giddy sense of triumph, a faint, persistent pain roiled through him. He knew that Kitsune was simply and purely relentless. But Lindsay had a fault line through him, an aching seam where his training met his other self. Now, at his finest moment, when he wanted to relax and feel an honest joy, it came up tainted. All around him the crowd was exulting. Yet something within him made him shrink from joining them. He felt cheated, twisted, robbed of something that he couldn't grip. He reached for his inhaler. A good chemical whiff would boost his discipline. Something tugged the fabric of his jumpsuit, from behind him to his left. He glanced quickly over his shoulder. A black-haired, rangy young man with flinty gray eyes had seized his jumpsuit with the muscular bare toes of his right foot. "Hey, Target," the man said. He smiled pleasantly. Lindsay watched the man's face for kinesics and realized with a dull shock that the face was his own. "Take it easy, Target," the assassin said. Lindsay heard his own voice from the assassin's mouth. The face was subtly wrong. The skin looked too clean, too new. It looked synthetic. Lindsay twisted around. The assassin held a bracing wire with both hands, but he reached out with his left foot and caught Lindsay's wrist between his two largest toes. His foot bulged with abnormal musculature, and the joints looked altered. His grip was paralyzing. Lindsay felt his hand go numb. The man jabbed Lindsay's chest with the toe of his other foot. "Relax," he said. "Let's talk a moment."
Lindsay's training took hold. His adrenaline surge of terror transmuted into icy self-possession.
"How do you like the performance?" he said.
The man laughed. Lindsay knew that he was hearing the assassin's true voice. His laugh was chilling.
"These Moondock worlds are full of surprises," he said.
"You should have joined the cast," Lindsay said. "You have a talent for impersonation."
"It comes and goes," the assassin said.
He bent his altered ankle slightly, and the bones of Lindsay's wrist grated together with a sudden lancing pain that made blackness surge behind his eyes.
"What's in the bag, Targ? Something they'd like to know about back home?"
"In the Ring Council?"
"That's right. They say they have us under siege, all those mech wireheads. But not every cartel is as straight as the last, and we're well trained. We can hide under the spots on a dip's conscience."
"That's clever," Lindsay said. "I admire a good technique. Maybe we could arrange something."
"That would be interesting," the assassin said politely.
Lindsay realized then that no bribe could save him from this man. The assassin released Lindsay's wrist. He reached into the breast pocket of his jumpsuit with his left foot. His knee and hip swiveled eerily.
"This is for you," he said.
He released a black videotape cartridge. It spun in free fall before Lindsay's eyes. Lindsay took the cartridge and pocketed it. He snapped the pocket shut and looked up again. The assassin had vanished. In his place was a portly male sundog in the same kind of general-issue dun-brown jumpsuit. He was heavier than the assassin, and his hair was blonde. The man looked at him indifferently. Lindsay reached out as if to touch him, then snatched his hand back before the man could notice. The lights went up. Dancers came on stage. The bubble rang with howls of enthusiasm. Lindsay fled along the bubble's walls through a nest of legs tucked through loopholes and arms clutching handholds. He reached the anterior airlock. He hired one of the aircraft moored outside the lock and flew at once to the Geisha Bank. The place was almost deserted, but his credit card got him in. The enormous guards recognized him and bowed. Lindsay hesitated, then realized he had nothing to say. What could he tell them? "Kill me next time you see me?" To catch birds with a mirror was the ideal snare. The Yarite's network of beads would protect him. Kitsune had taught him how to work the beads from within. Even if the assassin avoided the traps, he could be struck down from within by high voltage or sharp flechettes. Lindsay walked the pattern flawlessly and burst into the Yarite's quarters. He opened a video screen, flicked it on, and loaded the tape. It was a face from his past, the face of his best friend, the man who had tried to kill him, Philip Kuri Constantine.
"Hello, cousin," Constantine said.
The term was aristocratic slang in the Republic, but Constantine was a plebe, and Lindsay had never heard him put such hatred into the word.
"I take the liberty of contacting you in exile."
Constantine looked drunk. He was speaking a little too precisely. The ring-shaped collar of his antique suit showed sweat on the olive skin of his throat.
"Some of my Shaper friends share my interest in your career. They don't call these agents assassins. The Shapers call them antibiotics. They've been operating here. The opposition is much less troublesome with so many dead from natural causes. My old trick with the moths looks juvenile now, very brash and risky. Still, the insects worked well enough, out here in the moon docks. Time flies, cousin. 5 months have changed things. The mechanist siege is failing. When the Shapers are trapped and squeezed, they ooze out under pressure. They can't be beaten. We used to tell each other that when we were boys, remember, Abelard? When our future seemed so bright, we almost blinded each other sometimes, back before we knew what a bloodstain was. This Republic needs the Shapers. The colony's rotting. They can't survive without the biosciences. Everyone knows it, even the radical old. We never really talked to those old wireheads, cousin. You wouldn't let me. You hated them too much. And now I know why you were afraid to face them. They're tainted, Abelard, like you are. In a way, they're your mirror image. But now you know what a shock it is to see one. Constantine grinned and smoothed his wavy hair with a small, deft hand. But I talked to them. I came to terms. There's been a coup here, Abelard. The advisory council is dissolved. Power belongs to the Executive Board for National Survival. That's me, and a few of our preservationist friends. Vera's death changed everything, as we knew it would. Now we have our martyr. Now we're full of steel and fury. The radical old are leaving, emigrating to the mech cartels where they belong. The aristocrats will have to pay the cost for it. There are others coming your way, cousin. The whole mob of broken-down aristos. Lindsays, Tylers, Kellens, Morrisseys. Political exiles. Your wife is with them. They're squeezed dry between their shaper children and their mechanist grandparents, and thrown out like garbage. They're all yours. I want you to mop up after me, tie up my loose ends. If you won't accept that, then go back to my messenger. He'll settle you. Constantine grinned, showing small, even teeth. Except for death, you can't escape the game. You and Vera both knew that. And now I'm king, your pawn. Lindsay shut off the tape. He was ruined. The kabuki bubble had assumed a grotesque solidity. It was his own ambition that had burst. He was trapped. He would be unmasked by the Republic's refugees. His glittering deceptions would fall apart to leave him naked and exposed. Kitsune would know him for what he was, a human upstart, not her shaper lover. His mind raced within the cage. To live here under Constantine's terms, in his control, in his contempt, the thought scalded him. He had to escape. He had to leave this world at once. He had no time left for scheming. Outside, the assassin was waiting, with Lindsay's own stolen face. To meet him again was death. But he might escape the man if he disappeared at once. And that meant the pirates. Lindsay rubbed his bruised wrist. Slow fury built in him. Fury at the shapers and the destructive cleverness they had used to survive. Their struggle left a legacy of monsters. The assassin. Constantine. Himself. Constantine was younger than Lindsay. He had trusted Lindsay, looked up to him. But when Lindsay had come back on furlough from the Ring Council, he'd painfully felt how deeply the shapers had changed him. He had deliberately sent Constantine into their hands. As always, he had made it sound plausible, and Constantine's new skills were truly crucial. But Lindsay knew that he had done it selfishly, so that he'd have company, outside the pale. Constantine had always been ambitious. But where there had been trust, Lindsay had brought a new sophistication and deceit. Where he and Constantine had shared ideals, they now shared murder. Lindsay felt an ugly kinship with the assassin. The assassin's training must have been much like his own. His own self-hatred added sudden venom to his fear of the man. The assassin had Lindsay's face, but Lindsay realized with a sudden flash of insight that he could turn the man's own strength against him. He could pose as the assassin, turn the situation around. He could commit some awful crime, and the assassin would be blamed. Kitsune needed a crime. It would be his farewell gift to her, a message only she would understand. He could free her, and his enemy would pay the price. He opened the diplomatic bag and tossed aside his paper heap of stocks. He opened the floorboards and stared at the body of the old woman, floating naked on the wrinkled surface of the waterbed. Then he searched the room for something that would cut.